Thank you, Geneva. Well, in a few hours, I'm going to be flying back home to catch up with my family home in Surrey, and I'm going to be taking some great ideas to do the last few laps of my own homeschooling journey with teenagers. I find this convention always such an encouragement and a shot in the arm, and I hope it's been that for you this weekend, too. So,
closer.
Okay. Is this good enough? Okay. Well, I'm going to start off with a little confession. They say confession is good for the soul, so that's where we'll start. Last year, a friend of mine told me about this brand new parenting book she had bought by Dr. Lehman, Have a Perfect Kid by Friday. And I will be honest, my first reaction was to roll my eyes, to say, how presumptuous, and good luck with that. And I wouldn't even touch the book. Didn't even want to look at it. And then this spring, when I was casting about for some catchy title for my best teaching practices seminar, I thought, hey, why not? I'll play off this title. And I came up with Be a Terrific Teacher by Friday, sent it off to the review committee, and before I turned around once, they said, sure, that sounds great. And then I realized that I needed to put together my own presumptuous sounding summary of teaching practices. So it was a bit of, we better do some research. And as I did research, I realized that there's entire masters and doctorates that you can get on this subject. So this is going to be a short overview of the best teaching practices. The good thing with teaching practices is that people have been teaching for thousands of years, and as I did my research, I realized that the same ones keep coming up over and over again. They've been around for thousands of years, so they're well tried out, and so that made the summary a little bit easier. Now, for some of you who have been homeschooling for a while, you will probably find that you've already been using these tools instinctively. You just know they work. And so then you can walk out this door feeling very affirmed that you are doing the very best job possible. And the rest of you who maybe have just started with homeschooling, then hopefully you'll get some ideas of how to make your schooling more effective. The other little confession is that I was not able to condense this seminar into 7 topics. I'm squeezing in 8, so let's just consider it a time warp week. At the end, if there's some time left, I'd be happy to take any questions that you have. When you think back to your own high school days or your own elementary schooling years, did you have a favorite teacher? And why was this teacher a favorite? I very clearly remember my grade 11 biology teacher here in Kelowna, Dr. Veach. And there are 2 things that were special about him. First of all, he had a sense of humor, and when you're teaching teenagers, you need a sense of humor. And he also treated us not as the awkward, hormonally challenged adolescents that we were, but he treated us with respect, like fellow human beings that were actually capable of learning. And that actually pulled the best out of us. And that brings us back to almost the very beginning of teaching, back to Socrates, who had the same attitude towards his students. He saw them as capable of learning and growing in their understanding, and he was just their facilitator. He was just their guide. So maybe the first question we'll start off with is, how do you think about your children? Because how you think about them will determine how you treat them. And that leads into our first best teaching practice, which I think you have probably bumped into throughout this weekend through different speakers under different topics. The most successful teachers have a good relationship with their student. The student needs to feel respected, valued, supported, cared for. And I say feel because we love our children. But us loving our children is sometimes very different from them feeling loved. We want to be there for our children, see them as successful, but that might be very different from the way they receive it. And you probably understand that. Now, you might also think, well, that's a given. I mean, they're my children. I've chosen to sacrificially homeschool them. Of course they're going to feel loved, and of course we're going to have a great relationship. Well, just need to remember that we're adding teaching responsibilities to on top of everything else we do. The home, the volunteering, the cooking, the cleaning, the working, the whatever it is, the teaching is on top of it. And what that adds up to is being very time pressured for most of us. And that equals distraction. And that equals major multitasking. And those things can weaken our connection with our kids. It wasn't until I read a book by Gary Chapman several years ago called Love Languages that I realized that my children had become used to talking to me with little eye contact. When they wanted to show me something they had discovered outside or a new project or a picture, it was rushed on my part. When they were telling me something, it was with half an ear. After a while, they started to come to me and say, "Mom, are you upset?" And if I checked in the mirror, I had this sort of pinched look, you know, that sort of frustrated, pressured look as I was trying to juggle so many balls. And I realized that the main reason for homeschooling, which is to have a strong, great connection with your kids, was being jeopardized because I had so much on my plate. So I had to reorganize my priorities and choose to do less. You've heard it before. You can only do a few great things. That means a lot of good things have to be left. And that is very difficult. I somehow always think that we can fit in more than we can. So good relationships is the key to being a successful teacher. And that includes intent listening. That includes sharing interests. That includes focused conversations. And just making sure that the child feels cared for and loved. There's a saying that goes, "They don't care what you know until they know you care." And if they feel like a project, if they just feel like another thing on your to-do list, they will not be very receptive to what you want to give them or what you want to do with them. So that's the first. The second best teaching practice lends itself very well to homeschooling. It is that of knowing your student. Plato, thousands of years ago, said, you need to really observe the student so that you understand their natural inclination. And then tailor the teaching. Thousands of years ago, Plato was already espousing that. In today's educational lingo, it's called strengths-based teaching. And there's three parts of that. There's personality, there's learning style, and there's interests. If you take those three considerations with your children and you try to match the curriculum or how you teach them, you're going to have a winner. It makes such a difference, especially when they're young and especially when they're having difficulty with mastering a skill or having a difficulty with the topic. With personality, one can spend weeks on that, but the one thing I want to point out is that there are very different ways of learning. Some children really need the tutorial style. They need to learn in relationship, through discussion, through somebody doing it with them, sitting right beside them. That's the one extreme. The other extreme are personalities that need to learn in their own space, that need to be autonomous. Those are two extremes. And then, of course, you'll find children in the middle. But if you're doing the tutorial style with a child that desperately needs space and needs just to be given the work and left alone, you're going to have so much friction. And vice versa. So it's really important to sort of, from that aspect, look at your child and go, okay, what's going to work best for them at this point? Then learning styles. You're all very familiar with them. There's lots of great books out there. I think one of my favorite is Cynthia Tobias's The Way They Learn. I found that very helpful. So if your child has a very dominant learning style, You could be the most brilliant narrator of history or explain science, but if they're not an audio learner, it's going to fall entirely flat, and it won't be your fault. It's just the fact that they don't sort of receive information very well that way. You can have the best sequential text-based workbook, but if you have a strong visual and spatial learner, they're going to get lost in all the text, and it'll fall flat, and then you're frustrated. You know, why isn't this great curriculum working? Well, if they have a dominant learning style, it's not going to match up. When I first started, I was very basic, no frills. It was a piece of paper and it was a pencil. And I quickly learned that this was not going to work for my firstborn, who was a very, very strong kinesthetic learner. He needed to learn by doing. And so I quickly realized that how I taught was almost more important than what I taught. That if it doesn't match up to a learning style, you can have so many frustrations and avoidable conflict. So if you can match up the learning to their learning style, you have an enormous leverage, and it'll really smooth the way. So besides personality and learning style, then there's the aspect of interests. In the elementary years, you're really laying the foundation, the reading, the writing, the basic math. And if they're struggling with any one of those, just target their interests. Enable them to learn through the thing that they're most passionate about. It melts resistance, it evaporates some of the fear, and it certainly gets their interest rather than working with a child that's very bored and uncooperative. My youngest, she's in grade 8, and this year she had to write a process paragraph. She's a very reluctant writer. And I thought, well, how can we make this painless or a little less painful? I mean, the point is for her to learn how to do this, right? Not so much what she's writing about. So I deviated from the curriculum suggestions, and I said, write me a paragraph on how to prepare a horse for riding. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I wish you could have seen it. With a spark in her eye, she was off, and she wrote a fabulous paragraph completely independently, which was an enormous relief to me. And it just reminded me again that if the child is interested in something, familiar with something, then they are so much better able to apply that to a new skill or practicing something. So use it. And I understand that, you know, you may get very tired about counting insects, learning about insects, or maybe it's Star Wars, or maybe, I don't know what it is with your child. I understand you get very tired of it, but it won't last. Because after those elementary years, when they have the basic skills more or less down, then they can take those skills and apply them to other areas where they're not quite as interested. But especially in the foundational years, it is such a help. So strength-based teaching really leads to academic success. It's not spoiling them. You can't do it with absolutely everything, but do it wherever you can. When I first started out, I saw my children as empty pots, and I was the fact stuffer. And it was my job to see how much I could cram in. And it wasn't until a few years later that I realized that there was a much better perspective out there to approaching your children. And it's one that they come to you with a complex working mind that they can apply to learning and growing in their understanding. Real learning is not so much about memorizing facts as it is about understanding concepts. As it is about making connections, understanding cause and effect, and being able to take something they know and reapply it in a new situation. Which leads us to our next best teaching practice, which is the essential question. When I was first thinking about an analogy I could give you as to how the brain is wired, I came up with a library, you know, the ones that have books from the bottom to the top. And I wanted to tell you that the brain is wired as if you go to the library and you ask the librarian a question, and then she scurries about helping you. And I realized that was a very outdated analogy. No librarian scurries today. that I needed to come up with a more contemporary one. And so imagine yourself, you're at the computer, you Google, you key in your question, and then the search engines start. This is the way our brain is wired. When you are asked a question, your brain is like an enormous search engine, and it is searching through all its files, looking to see, do I know anything about this? Is there anything related? Have I ever experienced this before? Pulling everything together on that question. So when you teach by asking an essential question, it really engages the mind. It pulls the child into the subject. So it can't be a question that can be answered by yes or no, obviously. It can't be a question where they just are regurgitating facts. It needs to be a question where they need to really look for the answer. So the question will lead the student, and the question will need to focus on the essential thing you want them to learn, the principal part. The question will help them to reapply what they already know, to consider alternatives. And as they're looking for the answer, they will become aware of the missing information that they have. And when they become aware of what they don't know, it leaves space for new information. They now are intrigued. What do I need to actually figure this out? So an essential question, if you start a topic with that, it will lead to more questions. It will pique their curiosity. It draws students to the subject. It requires thinking and logic. Socrates also used this method exclusively. The way he taught is he would ask his students a question. In their coming up with the response, they had to bring everything they had to the table. Then he would counter it with another question, leading them closer and closer to a deeper understanding and greater truth. This is called investigative dialogue. So the learning becomes a treasure hunt for the answer. If you don't know the answer, because if they start to ask their own, you may bump into this. There's no need to panic. You just join the search. I think one of the essential skills for a person that can almost do anything they're called to do in life is to know where to find answers. You don't need to know everything. You need to know where to look. And so join the search and find the answers with them. So the challenge would be in when you formulate your question, that it really zeroes in on what specifically you want them to learn about this topic. The other thing when you ask a question is you need to wait for the answer. So often, after 30 seconds, we're like, okay, well, if you don't know, here it is. That's not the point. Wait. Don't be anxious if they get it wrong. Don't laugh. When they get the wrong answer, they will come up with some of the most fabulous answers. But after they've had a chance to think about it, give you their ideas, maybe you've countered with another question or an observation, then if it's possible, allow them to observe the subject or look at a model of it or something like that. Give them some resources and allow them to continue the search, the self-discovery. This, of course, takes time. It's not as containable as a workbook, but it does lead to incredible comprehension and retention. That's the really strong points to that. So let me give you a few ideas of what an essential question would look like. For an elementary age child, if you're studying spiders, you could start with the question, how do spiders spin their web? And see what they come up with. Then if it's possible, allow them to observe a spider. Now that's always, well, that's sometimes hard to coordinate. So you might want to have a video on spiders spinning their webs, but I would suggest that you play it for them muted. So they have to just watch and see if they can figure it out. And then through other resources, lead them to the discovery of how a spider spins their web. And they'll never forget it because they have been part of the search. With an older child, multiplication. You can present the question with a practical problem. If you had a paper route and they only paid you in pennies, what would be the fastest way of counting it? And then give them a pile of pennies and let them sit there and see. Some children will figure it out. Give yourself another pile of pennies and then tell them, I'll race you. And as they start to usually count one by one and you're skip counting, they begin to see through that real life experience and then also through the questions you've asked, that there is a point to being able to skip count. And once they understand the reason behind multiplication, then the rest is just memorization. But if they understand the value of it, it makes such a difference in the whole process of memorizing the times table. With older students, let's say they're studying prime ministers, if you start your study or your unit off with, what qualities lead us to conclude that a leader is successful? Now they need to really think. What are our values? How do we perceive success? And that sort of thing. And so it leads to a lot of wonderful discussions and a real thinking through and understanding of their culture, their world, their values, and that sort of thing. Yes, some learning needs to be memorized, for sure. But wherever possible, especially when you're starting out, maybe with the unit study in socials or science, start with an essential question, and you'll find that the journey is a lot more interesting for the child as they're involved. So educators, as I said, have been for thousands of years trying to figure out how to become more effective teachers. And so through trial and error, they've tried all different sorts of methodology. Besides the good relationship with the student, knowing the child, asking essential questions, the next big one that they discovered was personal sensory experience. Way back, and it absolutely amazed me how, for how many years already, educators have discovered things that we use today. You know, we think that we're so bright and we've come up with it, but no, they've been around for hundreds of years. Comenius in 1600 said, everything should, as far as possible, be placed before the senses. So he already understood the value of allowing especially younger children to learn through their senses. When he was teaching, there were no child-centered books, curriculum, and so he came up with the idea of having a picture with the name of the creature or thing, and then few comments about it. And this book was published, and it was completely revolutionary at that time because it included a visual. Now, today we take that completely for granted, right? But he used the sense of sight, and that book was the major resource for teaching children for 200 years. Isn't that amazing? A few decades or a few centuries later, we have Friedrich Froebel, I think in Germany. He's the father of all kindergarten. He says, knowledge acquired in our own active experience is more living and fruitful than that conveyed only by words. And he really believed that. He designed an entire set of manipulatives through which to teach children, geometrical shapes, all sorts of things that they could manipulate and understand concepts. So the understanding was more key than, you know, being able to regurgitate facts. I actually read about Froebel that his ideas, his manipulatives, were exhibited at the first, I think it was the first expo in England. They had a kindergarten class set up with these teachers using these manipulatives, and people could walk by and observe. I thought, wow, that's a little different than we do it today. Then Dewey, not the decimal Dewey guy, but former Dewey, he continued this idea of sensory learning and added to it activity-based things, life experience outside of the classroom. And today we have Montessori, which is based almost entirely on sensory learning. So sensory learning isn't just limited to objects, of course, or models, but real-life experiences. Things like playing store, which is probably what a lot of you have already done. I tell you, there's nothing as motivating as having your children buy their own snack at the family store to learn the value of money and making change and sort of thing. And they're so enthusiastic. It really makes learning so much more fun rather than some of the other drier methods. Or plant a garden. There's so many things they can learn about roots and plant pests and that sort of thing. My children loved when we learned about capillary action. They loved sticking that celery stalk or that carnation into the dyed water and watching the color rise up and distort things. If you're teaching your children about mixing colors, give them the three primary colors and sit down with them and say, well, what happens when you add this and this? And enable them to discover for themselves rather than just telling them about it. So wherever possible, allow them to discover it for themselves through their own senses, their hands, their eyes, their ears, their smell, their taste, and it will stick with them. And you'll probably have a very enthusiastic learner. So we learn, learning is more than just absorbing facts. It's discovering new connections, meanings, and understanding. Of course, this type of teaching takes more time, more effort, and more mess. Why is it always that way, huh? But at the end, they better understand and they remember it. So wherever you can relax enough to include that in the way you teach something, you'll be off and running. Einstein said, learning is experience. Everything else is just information. In the last 20 years, a lot of research has been done on the brain. And they were looking to understand better how we learn and looking for more strategies to be more effective. And one of the things they discovered is the importance of movement. They have found that the more active the child, the higher the grades. It also brings down distraction, fidgeting, and the zoning out. Do any of your children ever zone out? Yes, they look like they've gone to another planet. Well, they might need an activity break. Neurological research has shown that when a child is active, it actually creates new pathways in the brain. This is a good thing, especially if the movement is cross-lateral. I'll see if I can do this. You know, where you're tapping your ear with the opposite hand and, you know, rubbing your knee that way and something. Those cross-lateral movements, they make cross-lateral connections in the brain from the right to the left hemisphere. And the more you have of those, the more both sides of the brain focus on the subject that you're teaching. So cross-lateral exercises are very important, especially if your child tends to not want to be very active, likes to just sit and read, that sort of thing. If you can get them being a bit more physically active, it'll be a big help. It increases language skills, and it sparks curiosity, which, of course, increases attention. Also, the increased activity with the extra blood flow brings more oxygen to the brain, and they're better able to focus. So if you find that your children are zoning out or fidgeting, take an activity break. Try some cross-lateral exercises. See if you can do them without anybody hurting themselves. Another fun game with young ones is to put on some music, let them run around, and then they have to freeze when you turn that music off. Or if you've got enough children, you can do mirror partners where they have to take turns mirroring what the other person does. You can do shadow boxing. Whatever your children enjoy doing without it getting entirely out of hand. So for, you know, 5 minutes there, give them an activity break, and you may find that they're much better able to focus again on their schoolwork, if that's what you're doing. It's also great to be able to include movement in the learning itself. Some teachers do a syllable stomp. You know, when you're trying to find the syllables in a word, they'll have the child stomp it out. Role-playing what they're learning is another very common way of making it active. You know, you can become the sun and your children can become the planets orbiting around you, that sort of thing. When I was teaching my children to skip count, I took a long piece of paper and divided it into small, well, not small squares, but squares big enough that they could step on, you know, 1 to maybe 10, 12. And then for skip counting, they had to jump from one to the other. And in that physical movement, you know, so maybe what did we get up to? Skip counting by 4. After that, I don't think they could jump that far anymore. But they realized if you skip count by 2, you're over 1. You're like you're missing 1. And if you skip count by 3, you're going over 2. And just that physical activity, children, I think most of them, need it so much to really understand the concept rather than just well, mommy wants me to learn this, so it's 2, 4, 6. And yet they don't really understand. And if they don't really understand, then it's not useful information to them. They can really only give it back to you in the form that you've given it. It's very difficult for them to reapply it. If you're teaching them the clock, how to read time, maybe their hands can become the clock, anything you can think of to make the learning active, especially with young children. So movement is a best teaching practice that is certainly worth trying to include. You've heard it said, a picture is worth 1,000 words, and it is absolutely true, especially if you have a strong visual and spatial learner. Whenever I am going to start on a new topic, whether it be science, socials, whatever it is, I first head to the library, and I go to the children's section, where they have the picture books, and I bring home an armload of those with rich visuals, because it introduces a topic like nothing else can. It usually always stimulates interest. And at a glance, they get a mental picture, which really leads to better comprehension and recall. Another great visual to include are posters. If you've got a place where you can put posters on the wall, these are wonderful. It gives them a summary of the topic or the subject and helps them to connect a lot of the information they're going to get. So posters, you know, the food pyramid, the feudal system, the rain cycle, the planets. There's lots of posters out there. If your budget doesn't allow to buy posters, or you can't find any, then create them with your children. They love to see their work up on the wall, and it will really help them in remembering and just seeing how all the pieces fit together. The posters are a great idea. When it comes to writing, it's, unless you're doing creative writing where they're writing from a picture, it's a little bit more difficult, except that they do have what is known as graphic organizers. You're probably familiar with it. If you Google graphic organizers, you'll get tons of different kinds. Depending on what you want the child to do, there's a graphic organizer for it. So let's say, for example, your child has a very difficult time in writing in sequence. This happened first and then that. So what they recommend is you have them create a storyboard, and they don't need to be an artist. You know, you just do give them a piece of paper which has little squares, and then they need to, in the first square, do a stick man or a word or something of what happened first. And they fill in these little squares, just like a cartoon. And then when they write, they follow those squares. And for some children who have a very hard time putting their thoughts down in an organized fashion, this is a lifesaver. Or if they just need to do a creative piece, an idea wheel, where in the hub they put down their topic, and then they just write or draw pictures of all the things that are connected to it. And this will help them in formulate their writing. So the only trick with graphic organizers is that you need to make sure you pick the right one for the type of assignment that you've given them. But that can be a tremendous visual help for children that have difficulty. Another thing I've also done is to look at the art of the period of history that I've been studying. And it really broadens the whole subject for the child, because you can tell a lot about a culture by just looking at the art. What dimension is it in? How skilled is this? How does it compare to the last civilization we studied? How many colors do they use? Is it only line drawings? And in just really looking at the art, you can also see what was important to them and that sort of thing, how they like to represent themselves. You just have to watch out for the nudes, right? There's a lot of that in some of the eras. So wherever you can, add visuals to your teaching, and you'll find that it'll really help the children with retention. Music matters. A lot of research has also been done on how music affects us. The two institutions are Lindt and Boltzmann. They have done probably decades of research on that, and they were trying to find out, how does music affect us, and how can we harness that to improve learning? And of course, they discovered that humans are profoundly affected by music, and not only physically, but emotionally, spiritually, and cognitively. Now, we knew that all intuitively, We didn't need to do all the research for it. We know that when we want our child to fall asleep, a lullaby is going to be a lot better than the aerobic workout tape. And when we want to have a nice candlelit dinner, there's a certain music that would go with that. So we intuitively know that music matters, right? It builds an atmosphere. I remember once as a teenager, I'm a firstborn, and so I was always standing close to my parents listening in on their conversations. And I remember once a friend of theirs was talking to my parents and saying, you know, when my guests have stayed too long, I put on this certain record and they're gone within minutes. And, you know, I've never forgotten that. And I've always wondered, what was that music? Not, of course, that I have any unwelcome guests, but it's just left me very curious. So there are institutions such as the Accelerated Learning that have taken what's come out of all this research and they have applied it to their methods. And what they have found is that music, which has a 50 to 70 beats per minute, Baroque music would be an example of that, enables the brain to reach the alpha wave length. And at the alpha wavelength, memorization and focus learning is optimized. So in the accelerated learning methodology, they will have you play music of 50 to 70 beats per minute as background music because it gets the brain in that alpha wave and then your child's already set up to focus and concentrate. I did that for many years. The Lint Institute put out some music called Relax with the Classics, which had that 50 to 70 beat. And that worked for me because I grew up with my father only playing classical music, so that suited me quite fine. For some of you, you know, classical music is not going to work, and so maybe you can find other music that has 50 to 70 beats per minute. But music has more benefits than just focus or concentration. It can also, as we know, create atmosphere. So if everybody's feeling rather grumpy one day, would it hurt us to put on some happy music? You know, it will really make a difference in how everybody's feeling. If everybody's really tired, Mozart, I know, with all its lively, happy music. Now, of course, again, if you're not into classic, you'll have to, you know, replace that with something else. But it can really change the energy level of yourself and your children. Specific songs can also help children know that it's time to transition from one activity to the next. That can be really helpful, especially some children have a hard time letting go of something or finishing up with something and switching. So if they know that, okay, mommy always plays this song when it's time to fill in the blank, it really helps them. Most young children really need consistency and things that are repetitive. We also know that with music, we just remember things better. And I know that there's probably a lot of scientific, you know, reasons for that, which I'm not going to give you right now. But lots of curriculum has harnessed that fact. When my children were much younger, we did geography songs, Sing Around the World. And I saw today that they have it for history and grammar and math. And so if there is something that your child needs to memorize, you want them to memorize, then find it on music, find it on some tape, and you'll find that it's almost painless unless they really dislike music. But, you know, most kids don't mind music, and it's fun for them then. And before you know it, they've got it memorized. So music has so many benefits. It can get the brain into the alpha wave place. It helps with memorization. It helps with atmosphere. And it really can enrich the learning. You know, if you're learning about Latin America or if you're learning about Indians, if you play the music of what you're learning, it just somehow helps them to have a broader feel for the culture, the person, all that sort of thing. It really enriches the learning. On the Accelerated Learning website, which I've given you on the back of your handout, I believe I've done that, yes, their website is really great. They have a section on resources. If after resources you go to music and learning, they have a list of music to activities. So if you need your child to calm down, they've got suggestions of music. If you need your child to memorize, they've got it. If they, so very, very specific needs to specific types of songs. So you might find that interesting if you're looking for some ideas. The last best teaching practice I actually didn't find in any of my research, which really surprised me because it's been around for since the beginning of time. And it's that of storytelling. Storytelling is just an excellent way of keeping the attention of the child and, once again, excellent retention. I don't know, I think it's part of human nature to be curious about other people, to want to get a glimpse into their life. And somehow we learn through other people's mistakes and challenges and that sort of thing. And, of course, Jesus used parables so often, and that in the telling of a story with very familiar circumstances, he embedded the truth or what they needed to remember in it. And so they could always remember that story. And wherever they were working or years later, they could remember that story and continue to think about what was it that he was trying to say to them. And it's the same with our children, whether it be history, science, a math concept. If you can find a story that tells them about it, they will be able to remember it in ways that are almost magical. So throughout my teaching, I have looked for curriculum that is story-based. So that's things like Greenleaf, Story of the World, and there's many other curriculums that are story-based. I have even found in the last few years that they are coming out with books that teaches science concepts and math concepts, like geometry concepts, which is just incredible. My children read Archimedes and the Door of Science, and they will never, ever forget what Archimedes learned when he stepped into the bath and the water spilled over. So whenever we read a story, it grabs our imagination, and somehow that leaves a much deeper impression than if they're just reading a textbook or hearing you recite facts. Just a word about teens, because a lot of this has been geared to the elementary school children. All of these best teaching practices will work more or less with teens, except there are three things that you need to remember with teens, because things, you know, are definitely shifting. With teens, they need greater autonomy. So allowing them to choose the music, allowing them to choose the movement, allowing the autonomy. So this is what you need to learn. How do you want to do it? That needs to be a factor when it comes to teenagers. Also, teenagers love, most of them anyway, novelty. It needs to be a little bit new, a little different, and then somehow it's so much more interesting. And relevancy. They need to know that it matters. When they ask the question, you know, will I ever use this, or does anybody care, or what difference does it make, come up with an answer. Because if you can show them a connection to it being useful to them or having made a difference somewhere in the world or something like that, they'll be much more cooperative. They want to know that's relevant and can't always do, but wherever you can, it will make a difference. So when it comes to best teaching practices, the how you teach and the way you teach makes an enormous difference. Make sure that you have a good relationship with your child. Don't just assume, check in. It's very easy with the busyness of our days to lose connection. We lost the heart of our firstborn for various reasons. And after reading Gary Chapman's book, we really applied those principles, and it took us 6 months to get his heart back. And so you don't ever want it to go that far just because of busyness and stress and other issues. Make sure you know your child. Harness their interests, their learning styles, because it's going to make such a difference. The remaining six best teaching practices, the essential question, sensory learning, including movement, visual aids, music, and stories, they're all going to be more or less equally effective. Depends on whether your child has a really strong learning style. And so if you haven't included any of them in your teaching, you know, just pick one and start with that and see if it makes a difference for them. So that's all I have to share on best teaching practices. That's just zooming right through it at warp speed. But I hope that gives you some helpful ideas. And I'm wondering if anybody has any questions. if anything didn't quite make sense or needed a few more comments on it. You know, that is a perfect example of how the stories will just engage them and enable them to remember. I remember teaching my children place value through Matthew C, and they had a wonderful thing about, you know, these different houses, the tens family, the hundreds family, and they all had these names, and you could only fit so many in each house. And, you know, and this whole long story about this street of called place value, and they just remembered it, right? So it's a very powerful tool. That sounds like a fabulous curriculum. Wish I could start over and use that. Thanks for mentioning it. Any other questions or thoughts? Great. Well, I hope that as you finish your homeschooling year, you do so with satisfaction and contentment, and that in September, if you're called to homeschool again, that you've got a few more ideas of how to make your teaching more effective and a lot more fun. So thank you very much.